morning. The time is 7:55 a.m. Mostly cloudy. Temperature 74 degrees.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Temperature 77 degrees.
Fly Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
WQOSR Mobile.
W2VL Repeater.
Hello, Bob. KD2KNH, also mobile.
Just had to take a quick look at the clock. It's still good morning.
Yes, it is, for a few more minutes anyway.
Yeah, I know we were getting close, because I just had some lunch at Subway as I was going out of town. I wanted to get something to eat first.
I had a hard time hearing you that time. You say you're on your way to Subway today, not BJ's? I'm on my way to Floor and Decor to buy a tile cutter.
All right, I'm in a bed, so I should be getting better. All right. Well, I could say I could give you a free one, but I threw the one out that I had.
Well, I did my ceramic work. This is a luxury vinyl plank that is more like ceramic. The stuff is super hard and super stiff. I was cutting with my table saw. I had a cheaper tile cutter that wasn't doing it. Really heavy duty stuff.
Yeah, okay. I don't know if you have a carbide bit blade on your table saw. That can make a big difference. But I think I know this stuff is more than a part of the rock. After I retired, I decided to rip up the 60-year-old tin tile off the basement floor, and I put down ceramic tile, 200 square feet. And I did need a tile cutter and a nibbler to take care of some of the spaces on the floor.
Understandable. I used a handheld grinding wheel and cut off what I needed. Worked out well, and didn't need a nibbler. I could just cut whatever I wanted. I was only doing backsplash, but I will be doing some tile floors in the basement as well, but that's on the long-term list. The short-term list is to get the kitchen done, the new refrigerator in, new stove is in the planning stages, and the whole living room is getting done as well today.
So it sounds like you're on a work vacation.
That's all it's been for 3 years. I'm not getting any younger. I want to get it done so I can just enjoy it maybe at some point. But I have to get things to a certain standard before I'm going to be happy.
Dolly, I've got news for you. You've only had the house 3 years. I've had my house over 50 years, and it's never done. I was just outside today. The infinite wisdom of the company that made one of my windows, they decided to put them together with something that is sort of a nail. Actually, it's more or less like a hard, straight piece of wire that they hammered into the corners to hold it together. And over the years, they have occasionally popped out. So I was fixing that today. I had to pull the pin out, put a little weld on the nail, and then push it back in and tap it in just a little bit below the surface of the wood. I'm hoping the JB Weld will keep it from coming out again.
JB Weld is a magic epoxy if you use the original version. I never had a lot of success with the 5-minute version, but the original JB Weld, you can do miracles with that stuff.
Yeah, it's good stuff, the original. I tried the 5-minute, and I'm not pleased with that. I'll wait 24 hours. They have another product, which I used to just got it in the black. It's a plastic mending epoxy that works quite well. It's very sturdy. I've actually fixed things that were made of plastic you know, where something broke off a corner, and I was able to repair the corner with that stuff. So, I'm a fan of some JG products.
You know, we keep that stuff in the shop, but it depends on what plastics we're going to be using it for.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It doesn't work on everything, but it works on most, and especially it works on PVC stuff. There is also, I found, a special super glue that's around that you can use on plastic, but it's like a 2 or 3 step process to use it.
KD2KH. Interesting. I know originally the super glue that they had come out with, it was too strong. People were really getting into trouble with it, so they had to kind of water it down.
The biggest problem everybody had with that stuff was gluing their fingers together.
I never understood how that could happen until it happened to me once. Luckily, there was a pharmacy next door that had some nail polish remover.
Yeah, a nail polish remover is basically acetone, and that's what they use to dissolve it before it gets hard anyway. Now, I had no excuse because almost every lab I did work in had gloves that I could have easily asked them for a pair of. But with the girls in the labs, most of the time, the gloves weren't big enough to fit me.
You know, I've run into that in a lot of labs I go to. They have little small gloves when they're available. But, you know, even though safety equipment has always been provided, I guess for legal reasons, we couldn't always work with it. Grumman, Fairchild, you know, just what wasn't workable. But, you know, we made do and survived.
Yeah, I know. People are a lot more conscious about that kind of stuff these days. When GE took us over, I had to go through classes on industrial safety and environments that I was never going to be in. You know, I learned about hot sticks and tag, lockout, tag out, all that kind of stuff that I never really ever used after.
It's amazing the administrative state, whether it be government or whether it be, you know, in business, they always come up with some kind of a training course that's supposed to solve problems, and, you know, this way they can check it off a checklist, but I've never seen it actually work in real-world applications. Like, they just close it off and say, that's taken care of, it's all fixed now.
I think mainly they want to show their insurance company at OSHA they've got a plan to minimize risk. I don't know how well that works sometimes. Although I will say, we had a very good riot and safety course that we had to take every year. It actually involved, at certain times, actually doing the road test to show that you had learned the material. That's what the FCC took us over. We were all driving company cars, so I guess they figured that cut down on the number of insurance claims they had.
Yeah, that's why they do it. Insurance purposes, OSHA, and whatnot. And sometimes courses, you know, you do get some helpful tips, but, you know, we have quality action teams in Grumman, too. You know, I was on them at Fairchild as well. And, you know, you come up with a solution, but then there was nobody to implement it. So they thanked us and gave us awards for whatever we suggested, and it never got implemented. Bob, I just arrived at my destination. I got to get in, buy something for the ride home, and get that cutter. Always nice speaking with you. 82 Canage, clear 73.
All right, Charlie, 73. Good luck with the tiling job, W2OSR. Thank you.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Fly Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
N2YYC.
W2OSR mobile.
W2OSR N2YYC, how are you?
Oh, good afternoon, Howard. I'm doing all right out here, just heading back home after doing a little shopping.
Okay, very good. Seems like we're finally getting some nice stretch of weather. Heading to Hexer State Park to do some bike riding. Did you buy any equipment?
No, I didn't get anything from Andy's estate. I've got enough of my own stuff my wife is yelling at me about getting rid of, and I'm old enough now where there are things I would have been interested in maybe even 10 years ago. I can't keep buying because I wouldn't use them enough.
Well, I looked at the list. It looks like a lot of test equipment for sale, not that many radios. So I didn't even go look.
Yeah, I've been to Andy's house a number of times. I know he has tons of test stuff. And that's only what he had in the house. And supposedly he had a storage locker somewhere that he had stuff in, too.
Really? I never heard about the storage locker. I know he had, I don't know if it was a garage or a shed in the back that was filled with stuff.
Yeah, he had a garage in the back that was two stories high. So he had the whole top filled with stuff. I don't even think he could walk up there. And then down below, he still had quite a bit of stuff. He almost had two workshops in the back in the garage. And he had all kinds of equipment and radios back there, too.
And two YYZ. Well, must have been a job unpacking that place.
Okay, W2O, sorry. Yeah, I think John Wilson and maybe Rich Cedron did most of the going through the stuff, cataloging it, figuring out what there was. It's a monumental job trying to get rid of stuff like that. You don't want to throw it in the dumpster because it does have value, but at the same time, what the heck do you do with it?
Well, do you know how they made out sales? Did they make much money from it?
I have no idea how they did. May hear something on it tonight on the InfoNet. And may say something.
What about the tower? Are they taking down the tower, do you know?
I don't know what they're going to do with the tower. That tower is so big, they'd have to get somebody professional to come in and remove it, unless they can disassemble it. But it was a 40-foot-high tower, and it was an ultra-heavy-duty one. How do I explain it? Standard tower is maybe not even a foot wide, probably 10 inches on each one of the sides. This one was over 18 inches on each side.
Oh, I heard there was a ham interest in the house. I don't know if anything happened with that.
I'm not sure. That might be the easiest way to do it. Then you wouldn't have to take all that stuff down. The only relative I knew of that Andy had was a sister. So, probably going to be her decision on who gets to buy it when they're ready to actually put it on the market.
Into YYC. I'd like to get a HF mobile rig, but I don't know. Seems like prices are up there.
Yeah, none of that stuff is going cheaply now. The COVID epidemic jacked up the prices on everything. The ICOM 706 Mark II was a very popular mobile radio, but they're getting old enough now, you're not going to find anybody that can fix them. So where do you go? I don't know what's a good mobile radio. I know ICOM still makes one or two. I guess the H2 has something. Kenwood, for an HF mobile radio, the only one they had, and I don't think they have it in the front line anymore, was the GS480. So, where do you go? I'm not sure. And then you got the antenna problem on the vehicle.
Have you gone on HF recently? I've turned it on a couple of times and seems not much happening.
Yeah, W2O, sorry. The bands aren't great. I get, mostly now when I get on, I'll get on in the morning, I'll get on with FT8 and see what's out there, see if there's somebody I haven't worked with. I've got a lot of countries I've worked. Not too many new ones I'm looking for. Sometimes I'm just filling in holes in what band or what mode I've worked somebody.
And to YYC, in Florida over the winter, I had a 10-meter radio with me, and it was a nice opening, but I seem to be done with for the time.
Yeah, I know 10 meters and occasionally 6 meters were pretty good earlier in the year. That seems to dry up right now. I've been on 10, every day I go to see what's there, and there's not much there right now. So I find one or two signals just a lot. 15 more active than anything below 15, down to about 40, you'll find somebody.
Okay, well, hopefully it'll open up again. You go down to our field day this year?
I do field day with the Minnesota Amateur Radio Club, which is Baldwin Harbor Park, which is all the way down the end of Grand Avenue, where we set up. It's a nice location. We did okay. It wasn't great. We're getting older, and we don't want to put up big, huge antenna systems anymore, so we've been doing wire antennas. The ones we used this year weren't the greatest.
Not really sure how Limark did. I stopped by the site, but they were just getting things going. So they still put up some towers, but they changed their location.
Yeah, I know they were in a different location. I'm not exactly sure where that park is. I know it's down on the south shore someplace, not too far from the water, but probably something like one of the bays down there, that's south of wherever the site is.
Yeah, the park is in Seaford on Siemens Neck Road.
Okay, so it's more or less down at the bottom of the Seaford Oyster Bay Expressway then.
Just east of the expressway, but yeah, in that vicinity.
Yeah, I live up on the north shore, so I don't know everything on the south shore too well.
What town are you in?
I'm in Glen Cove. I'm just, actually right now I'm just a couple of blocks away from the house. I went out to get gas at BJ's, and the milk is just more than a dollar a gallon, less than what it is in the local store, so you can pick up milk while I'm there.
Well, we, eggs, went down a little bit. Price kind of crazy there for a while with eggs.
Yeah, I spent all my wife is complaining about how much eggs are, but, you know, it's just the two of us most of the time, so, you know, one carton of eggs lasts us a week or more.
Well, I'm going to sign them at my destination. Nice talking to you. Enjoy the day. And to YYC.
Blocks between where I am now and the house. So I'll be home soon. W2OSO.
KD2, KNH Mobile.
November 2, Victor Hotel, Zulu. And to be... November 2, Victor Hotel, Zulu, and to VH. What's that? And to VH, Z-Mobile, what's that?
Fly Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
WB2ZSE and Y2H.
WB2EAV, listening.
W testing, testing. N2 UDW listening.
FlyMarkInfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
VHZ Mobile listening.
Is that N2YH? WB2MSB here.
Negative, negative. W2YSB. Nice to meet you. My name is Ken. You know, Uncle November. Ken is my name. Call sign is November 2, Victor Hotel Zulu. That is, again, November 2, very high Zeppelin. Like the Hindenburg, very hot Zeppelin, burning up on there in New Jersey. November 2, Victor Hotel Zulu. I'll copy. Back to you.
Okay, Ken. Fine business. Maury, Mike Alpha, Uniform Romeo Yankee, and sounds like you're coming from Nebraska. How you doing?
Hey, Maury, where are you located? Presently, I'm leaving the metropolis of... sprawling metropolis of Martin, South Dakota. Martin is a small community of about 1,000 people, nestled in the Pine Ridge Reservation, but yet isolated from the Pine Ridge. It was sold to be a separate community many years ago, where they are allowed to have alcohol, whereas in the Pine Ridge Reservation, alcohol is forbidden. So this community was sold and is considered to be exempt from the Pine Ridge. They have a whole small little town here called Martin, like the name, like a man's name, Martin. And I'm moving there. I was just out there, a biomedical officer for the government, and I was servicing one of our Indian health community clinics. And I'm headed back at the government vehicle linked into the hands-free system of the little government car that I'm driving back. I'm going back about 60 miles back to the main headquarters in the Pine Ridge Hospital. Back to you, Maury.
Oh, very good. Fine business. So were you GS or were you in Commission Corps?
No, it's nice that you mentioned that. No, I'm a civilian, and my colleague is Commission Corps. A lot of people don't know about that. But, yeah, hospital's full of Commission Corps. Nobody wants to work here. So they stick them here. But, you know, I have a funny story. When I was over in Germany, we had Commission Corps on our base when they sent all the active duty downrange. We didn't know what they were. They were wearing those Navy uniforms. We didn't know who they were. And they told us they came from the Pine Ridge. We didn't know what that was. They said, you better watch out. You may get stuck there one day. And here I am. Back to you.
Oh, roger, roger. Well, there's other places. You could go to Bemidji or... what's the other one? Rosebud? I actually flip-flopped between Navy and Commission Corps. I was lucky. I didn't have to change my uniforms, just my collar devices. And you're right. Nobody knows what to do with you. But we were told in our PHS training that when someone sees you walking down the street, as far as they're concerned, you're a naval officer. So you better be dressed like one and behave like one. Back to you.
Oh, yeah, my colleague, he just got promoted to Lieutenant Commander. And we're all happy for him. Lieutenant Commander Julius. And my neighbor, he's in Rosebud. He's 107 miles away. He's the other ham radio operator. And he just got his license. So I went over and helped him set up. He's in the other hospital over in Rosebud. I'm the only ham radio operator that's active. There's about 5 listed, and I know all of them. And 4 of them left, 3 of them left. One who's active is there. He's a pharmacist. And he's not on the air. He's not active. I'm the only one that's active on the Pine Ridge. Pine Ridge is the size of Connecticut. Rosebud's half our size. So I go over to visit my buddy. He's the other biomedical guy in Rosebud. I go over to visit him and help him set up his equipment. And I call him my neighbor because he's only 107 miles away. And he's loving the hobby. He just got involved in it about 6 months ago and loves it. He's the only other active ham, and he's in Rosebud. He's the only active ham in Rosebud. And they have two biomedical officers, but there's no commission corps there for them. We have three and one commission corps. Back to you.
Oh, roger, roger. Well, it's I think it's a calling, and it's definitely meaningful work. And I started out Navy, and I finished up my requirement after ROTC and decided I wanted to get back in, but they wouldn't take me because of the medical stuff. But they said, oh, you can go into the PHS. So I did that. And then what you described is exactly what happened. Everyone got deployed. There were all kinds of open billets. And the next thing you know, I was offered an inter-service transfer back to the Navy. All of a sudden, my medical issues didn't seem to bother them anymore. So there I was. And I'm still on the reserve list. So we'll see if they have to call me for something. If they get to my name, you know that they're way down on the list. But I did work with some IHS folks at a few different times in various places. One of them was, I'm trying to think of what the name of it was. It was way up in the northwest corner of the country, right on the Canadian border. I can't even remember the name of the place now. You probably know what it is. You had to take a ferry to get there. Back to you.
Boy, that's interesting. We see a lot of people come down from up in Alaska that way, come down here. This isn't, you know, it's, they get a service ribbon, Mission Corps people get a service ribbon being here because of the austere environment, you know, and it's, you know, I talk on a video, I'm a member of the club, and people speak to me, and they're shocked by the, you know, the distances I have to travel and stuff to go to. We're going to go food shopping, you know, 60 miles minimum. And, in the winter, you got to stock up on your food. You got to think ahead. But that's the way it is working out here. But it's rewarding work because you're actually working with the first people in this country, the indigenous race, you know. And they're very, very, very nice people, you know. And they're very beautiful. I don't know how you would say, my children go to school. Actually, I'm passing Allen, Dakota right now, the poorest community in North America right here, Allen, you know. And the people, if they have one ear of corn, they'll break it off and give you half of it. And that's all they have, you know. It's not as bad as what people say it is. I've been in Jersey City, New Jersey. That's worse than here, man. And I'm telling you, my kids go to school out here, and they love it. They wouldn't go anywhere else. I gave them the choice. Would you rather be here or where we have a house in Nebraska? It's here, Daddy. Don't retire. We like it here better. My kids honestly love it here, man. You know, and it's just that people are, they have this feeling about them, you know. This tribe, you know, the Lakota Sioux are very beautiful people. And it's going to be hard to leave, you know. But I can only do a couple more years and then it's going to be time to go because I'm getting old, you know what I'm saying? Back to you.
One of them that hates indigenous.
Roger, Ken. I do know what you mean. Very good. Well, I think it's part of our obligation to maybe make up a little bit for some of the bad decisions that were made in the past. You can't go back, but at least going forward, you can try to do the right thing, which I think is an important thing. I remember the place now. It was called Nea Bay. I think it was N-E-A-H Bay. Maybe that'll ring a bell for you. Back to you.
No, I never heard of it. But I've only been connected to this branch of service for a couple of years. So I never heard of that. I'm sorry about that. Back to you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no problem. Maybe mention it to your friends. I'm sure they may have heard about it. I ran into some people that would go from place to place. And it's interesting, Lakota Sioux, I believe, now correct me if I'm wrong, I believe Rosebud is Blackfoot, is that correct?
No, they're, I can't remember exactly right now, but they're not Blackfoot, they're different than this tribe. and they used to war with this tribe. They actually don't get along, but they don't cause any friction anymore. There's a distinct difference. When you go to Rosebud, they're more of a, you can tell they have a higher standard of living, put it lightly, you know. It's much nicer on that reservation. I don't remember what they actually are. I forgot right now, but my friends, they know right away because they work with them every day. But that's a nicer place to live, actually. They have the same living accommodations that I have. They pay less rent. They have nicer, you know, everything over there. Take care of their workers. Even though they're government, they donate everything to them. They take better care of their people over there than we do. It's a little rougher where I live, but it's completely different. And they have a church over there called St. Joseph's, and a lot of people around the world donate money to this church, and it's like a palace. And it's right there within the Rosebud Reservation. Back to you.
Okay, Ken, very good. Well, I guess based on your call sign and the dialect, I'm assuming that you're from somewhere in the New York area originally. But I can tell you that right now we're getting close to 90 degrees, back to being humid again. It's supposed to cool off a little bit tonight, maybe into the 80s. And we're really experiencing quite some heat here. I think it's supposed to get above the 90s, maybe close to 100 sometime in the next few days. Wondering what it's like where you are for weather-wise. Go ahead.
An interesting question. Yesterday we had 102 out of the Badlands, but in the Black Hills it was 100. So, we have the Badlands in the reservation, so I had to drive through the Badlands. Badlands is the interesting part where it looks almost like the moon, and they put highways through it. It just looks weird when you drive. It's so odd looking at both sides of your car. And then you come out of it, you go to Black Hills, where it's more lush, more greenery, and it gets a little cooler. So it was 102, 103 in one area that I was at, and it got to 98. So today they predict 100 again, and the next couple of days in the high 90s, 98, and so forth. Right now, overcast, and it's in the high 90s. And every night we get showers, a little bit of rain, you know, here and there. And the other days we get tremendous thunderstorms, but that's not predicted now. So I think you're going to be getting our weather. That's maybe what's going to go on. Back to you.
Yeah, Roger. I think that's what happens. I think that your weather today is our weather in the next couple of days. And we'll just have to put up with it because we can't do much about it. We had a very strange winter on Long Island. Last winter we got almost zero snow. Might have been a little dusting here and there, but I didn't take the snowblower out at all, which is really unusual. And we also have a place up in Vermont, pretty much no snow right up until the end of the winter, and then we got dumped on severely. So I'm going to wait to see what this winter is like. I thought I was going to have to get a new snowblower because of the blower we have now is about 25 years old, but I deferred that. We'll see what happens next time. There's a fellow that does net control for the Maritime Net, 14.3, who I forget his name and I forget his call, but he always identifies as being from the Black Hills. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. Go ahead.
No, I'll listen, though, to that. I can pick that up very easily. I listen to it, but I never paid attention to it that closely. That's interesting, you know. I know exactly what you're talking about. And from where I'm from, I lived in a town, you don't know it when I mention it, on the North Shore. I lived there for quite a few years, called Fort Washington. And then within Fort Washington, to be more specific, there's a little area that was quite unusual called Manhasset Isle. And in Manhasset Isle, I lived on a little hill called Pequot Avenue. It was a waterfront property. So we used to go down our boat every day out to Manhasset Bay and fish. When I was a kid, we went over to the town dock in Fort Washington and caught snappers and bluefish and went out in seaplane lanes when they used to land seaplanes out there. And they would land and they would go over to Manor Haven where they had a seaplane base. So I was very familiar with Manhasset Bay because I had a dinghy that I used to drive around when I was a kid. This would be considered suicide nowadays if you saw a 10-year-old kid driving around in a dinghy with like a 3-horsepower motor. I don't think they would allow that nowadays, you know, letting 10-year-old kids drive around in dinghies, you know, catching, you know, 10-pound blues, 12-pound blues, you know. But anyway, we did all that stuff back then, you know, and then we rode our bicycles over to the mill pond, ice skated, did all this crazy stuff back then in Fort Washington. And I went to Shriver High School even and learned how to fly, you know, and a Olympic trainer. So I lived in New Jersey also, and I lived in New York City. I did all those things over there. You know, I had a life over there in New York City too. And I lived in Queens and then I lived in Manhattan. I was born in Manhattan. And I lived in 3 different counties in New Jersey also. That's why I have a 2-call sign back to you.
WB2MSC here. Well, I tell you, Ken, you know, we might be cousins because we sound similar. I also fly, and I actually went up to Connecticut and got a seaplane rating. I never landed in Manhasset Bay, but it was a lot of fun. And as far as dinghies go, my kids are all in their 30s now. But when they were little, we had a boat at the Mount Sinai town dock, and I had I think it was a 9-foot inflatable. And the plate on it said that it would handle a 25-horsepower engine. So what I did was, is I went out and I got what you said. I got a 3-horsepower engine because I figured that the kids couldn't get into too much trouble with that. And I did the same thing. I would let them take that little dinghy out with the 3-horsepower engine, and they would go zipping around Mount Sinai Harbor. And I think they had more fun in that boat than they did in the big boat. And I think it taught them a few things. The most important of which is to check the fuel before they depart, because more than once they went out on the engine and had to come back rowing. Back to you.
Yeah, it happened to me in a sleep. It cut out on a seaplane lane. It landed right over the top of our heads. You know, flying out here is very important. I don't fly, but it's very important out here. It's a very important hobby to have, because these guys get their licenses at the airport. Many people out here pursue that hobby, because a lot of ranchers do it. They have these massive ranches. The only way they can keep up with the cattle is to go out and get their licenses. You know, they go out and follow their herds that way with their aircraft, and they go around and fly around, and they'll get these large tires on their aircraft, and they'll land out in the field with these large tire aircraft. And it's funny looking airplanes, these fat tires they use them to land in there. They make these their own runways, and they land right there on their own property. It's interesting. A lot of these ranchers have aircraft, pilots, just so they can follow their herds. So they have large, large ranches. Have you ever been out to Nebraska or South Dakota? They call it the Faces. It's called Mount Rushmore. Have you ever been up to Mount Rushmore or this area out here? It's very interesting to people that have big imaginations, because you can see what they do out here is massive. Everything is done on a big scale. It's not tall. It's horizontally large out here. Back to you.
Nope, I've never been to any of those states. I've never been to Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota. I've been to Kansas. My only experience for what you're describing is I was a TDY to a place called El Centro, California. I spent a month in El Centro, California, which is about 100 miles east of San Diego and about 10 miles north of the Mexican border at a naval air station. I was told I was going to replace someone that was on leave July. And when I got there, it was about 115 degrees. I felt like I was sitting inside a pizza oven. But I survived, and I lost some weight also, because one of the only buildings with reliable air conditioning was the gym. So I would go to the gym twice a day. So it turned out okay on the balance. It wasn't that bad. It would cool off at night, but during the day, 115, 117 was not unusual. So that's my experience with desert living. And Roger, on the seaplane, or not the seaplanes, on the planes with the fat tires, they have a similar situation in Alaska, but they use ski landing gear. And let me let it drop for a second. Interesting thing about the pilots in Alaska is that statistically only about 80% of them actually have licenses. The rest of them, they just fly.
Yeah, it's funny you said that because I was talking to the owner of a helicopter company here who flies tourist helicopters, and he's talking about how he has all these pilots and he discussed the ins and outs of it. And I said, so what kind of pilot training do you have? He says, none. I said, do you have a license? He says, no. I said, do you fly the choppers? He says, yeah. I fly them all the time. I fly them all around. I bring my family on trips. If I bring them up to the, you know, I bring them here, I bring them there, by helicopter. I said, do you even have a license? He goes, no, but I own them. I said, so let me get this straight. You don't have a license. You don't have any training. But you put your whole family into one of those helicopters, you take them places. He goes, yeah, it's easy. I learned by doing it, by watching the pilot do it. The pilot taught me how to fly it. And I take my whole family on a vacation somewhere up in the mountains, and then I'll take them back by helicopter. I said, but you don't even have training. He goes, I got taught by the pilot how to fly it. So I imagine that, like you're saying, there's a lot of people that just do this stuff like a hobby, you know? They don't even have a license to do it. Back to you.
Yeah, I guess you're right, but you take a lot of chance when you do that, especially when you're flying a commercial aircraft. But he might have been pulling your leg. I don't know. I would suspect that if that's his business, I don't know he would take that much of a chance. But I know in Alaska, in places where nobody ever goes and these guys go around, I know that is the case there. But I took some rotary lessons. I took about, I think I have 10 hours in a Robinson 22 helicopter. It took me about 10 hours to realize that I probably was going to die in that thing. And you can ask some of your, you know, helicopter pilot friends if it's true. A lot of them probably also fly fixed wings. They told us that it's a lot easier to learn how to fly a helicopter before you learn how to fly fixed wings. Because a lot of the things that you do are sort of backwards, even where you sit. You fly a helicopter from the right seat, but you fly a fixed-wing aircraft from the left seat. A lot of the instinctive things that you're trained when you're flying fixed-wing will get you killed if you do them in a helicopter. So I decided I had my fun, I learned a little bit, and I just never got back into the driver's seat on a helicopter again. I don't know if you are familiar with the area. I'm on the Northern State Parkway right now, just passing Willis Avenue to give you a little reminiscence of being on Long Island. Back to you.
Okay, very good. I was going to ask you where you were. Very good, yeah. And, wow, that's interesting what you just said about the helicopters, the rotary and the fixed wing, the difference. Boy, and he told me that most of his pilots do both. He hires. You know, I thought that was shocking. He told me he takes his family up in a helicopter. He owns them, you know. He does what he wants with them, like they're his toys, you know. And I said, so you have a license for both? He says, he has a license for neither. You don't even have a license? He says, no. But then you take your family up, and he says, well, I own them. I do what I want with them. I thought that was a little cavalier and crazy, you know, but he does what he wants with them. He says, he flies them around. So they're open and nobody on them? Absolutely nobody. You have the entire highway to yourself, always. Always. But in the winter, it can get kind of scary and creepy because it's always snowy and storm blows in. You got to navigate. It's always good to have four-wheel drive because you never know when you go over a little hill, it could be completely white out. You have to get through it, you know? And out here, the highways, like, you'd be really surprised and they've even built highways. Because of the lack of traffic, you know. But they have them, and you have to get from one point to another. I'll be crossing over one intersection here that has quite a few places to go. Like, you can go to Wounded Knee, which is quite famous, which is about 12 miles to my right, or Sharp's Corner, which is another waypoint, a little further. And there's no way to go grocery shopping or no way to pull over. It's just open prairie, you know, with sagebrush and scrub grass. And then you come across Wounded Knee, which is nothing but a big sign. They have a big sign explaining about the massacre of Wounded Knee. You know about Wounded Knee? It's one of the most famous
incidents that happened here on the reservation. Back to you.
Oh, yeah, I know about Wounded Knee. I think there were several books and movies written about it. I just, you know, while you were talking about that, I was wondering, so what do you do if you order something from Amazon? Does it ever get delivered? Go ahead.
We don't have U.S. postal delivery on the reservation. We have a mail, we have a post office. We can get a mailbox there. I don't have one. We don't have mail delivery, per se. Like, we're the mailman. But we do have UPS, and we do have FedEx delivery to our home addresses. So that's the preferred way of doing it. I get everything personally delivered to my home address in Nebraska. So that's 80 miles away. No big deal. I actually ordered some items Saturday, which was delivered to my house. During the week, no problem. I don't have anything delivered here, but they do deliver UPS and the other service. FedEx will deliver to the house here that we have. We all have houses and a secure, environment. The government provides us with quarters, nice little houses. They call it Beverly Hills, behind the hospital where we work. And we all, like everybody who lives there, is either uniform services or, officer level in from the hospital. About 100 houses there. Back to you.
Yeah, roger, roger. Yeah, base housing. I'm familiar with that. That's for sure. Sometimes they're really nice and secure. So I just passed the Meadowbrook Parkway. My QTH destination here is going to be Stony Brook. I don't know, you're probably familiar with Stony Brook. It's on the North Shore. And Fort Jefferson is right next door. That's where we pick up the ferry to head north if we have to go up to New England. And as far as traffic goes, I'm sure I don't have to tell you about the traffic here. It's bumper to bumper 90% of the time, unfortunately. So I try to do my traveling in the middle of the night if I can, and I try to set up my work hours, my work shifts, so that I can travel at off hours, but sometimes that doesn't work. Today is a little lighter than normal, and I understand it's because it's the summer, and also because of all the people that still telework on Mondays and Fridays, and that may stay for a while, I hope, because at least Mondays and Fridays are not as bad as they used to be. Ken, let me turn it back to you one more time, and then I got to go because there's been a couple of messages piling up on my little display here while we've been chatting. Let me send it right back to you, and then I'll give you a final report. WB2MSB. Back to you.
Yeah, I wish they would open up a commissary or a BX or something like that for us. They don't have that, though. That would be nice because, you know, we have to travel 60 miles to go buy our food. That's the closest town of Chadron, and as a Walmart. That's it. There's no other supermarket. And then if we want to do big shopping like Sam's Club or something to buy quantities,